How do everyone? It's been a while, but we're back with another OneLiner.com podcast. For the purposes of this podcast, we, as mentioned above, are myself, Craig Eastman, and as always, in sunny Glasgow, Scott Morris.
Hello.
And in almost as sunny Falkirk, Drew Tavendale.
Hello.
We're back on fine form with a stack of films you've probably seen and garnered your own opinion on already, thus rendering this pointless, but we are nothing if not determined and stubborn in our resolve. I was trying to think of some sort of communist slogan to build around that, but I can't.
Our cause is just, we must prevail.
Film viewers of the world unite. It's a bit lackluster, though. Anyway, five films to talk about today, so let us crack on. Okay, I'm assuming none of you listening have had your faces stuck in another dimension for the last 6 months, so you can't really have failed to have noticed that Harry Potter has come to a conclusion with The Deathly Hallows Part 2. Scott, the world and his donkey has been waiting on this. There's probably no point in filling anybody in it, but would you like to give us a recap of what's going on?
Well, it's a strange film to talk about, because almost as soon as it starts ending. It's a very little Part 2 that there's no time wasted in acquainting you with the events of the last part, just as the last part wasted no time acquainting you with the events of the other previous films. I suppose the first thing and the only real comment we've got on this film is that it's not a good place to start, but you'd have to be insane to pick this as a starting place for your journey into the world of Harry Potter. It is basically the conclusion of Harry's quest to defeat Voldemort. They find the rest of the Horcruxes and they have a big battle at the end of Hogwarts, which is underplaying quite a lot of what happens in the film, but I think it's pretty obvious to all what's going to happen here. I don't think there's much mileage in spending a hell of a lot of time recapping it, especially given the box office that it's done, which means that, as you point out, everyone has already seen it. The film as a whole just feels like the final act of a 7-part play, and we've just returned from a really long interval at a theatre bar. So a lot of what you'd say about movies doesn't seem to apply to the film. It's not. It defies an awful lot of criticism. I'm kind of torn. I found it somewhat anticlimactic, to be honest, for a couple of reasons. The cast, especially the kids, we've grown up with them. They've grown up. They've got a hell of a lot better at acting, which is a good thing. However, almost all of the emotion in this film took part in the first part. There's an awful lot of calmness in this film, mainly because it's all centred around Harry kind of coming to terms with and understanding what needs to be done to defeat Voldemort, and he's, in part, I guess, because he's kind of been training for this all his life, he kind of accepts it quite calmly and goes off to face his nemesis without really batting much of an eyelid, which is sort of fine when you can get access to his internal monologue like you do in the books, but in the film it doesn't really work so well because it just looks like he's going, all right, better go and fight Voldemort then. And it all seems a bit perfunctory. It's just, you know, there's nothing particularly emotional or thrilling about it. I mean, when your main rabble-rousing speech in this film comes from Neville, a tertiary character at the very best, there's something wrong going on. The other thing that's also worked far better in the books than it did in the films is the duels, which is obviously a hell of a lot of this film is based on big magical fighty things, which in all of these films has revolved around people chucking red and green lights at each other until somebody falls over. I don't know how else you would have done it, but in the books it's always described as these intricate battles of, you know, spells and counter spells, and it's there's actually some skill to it.
A bit like Pokemon.
Yeah, but all you get here is just a light show, and it's exactly the same light show, effectively, at the end of this film as you got at the end of the fourth film. So
all you get are the Ghostbusters crossing streams, basically.
It delivers the contents of the book competently enough, as I guess pretty much all the films have. But it doesn't seem to have any flair, it doesn't have an awful lot of emotional punch to it, there's no heft to it, it's just, it feels like a book just sort of crammed into the time and budget constraints of a film rather than something that's kind of been properly adapted for a film. I mean, the only reference point I can really come up with is something like Lord of the Rings, where again, while they're not a patch on the books that they came from, they did at least feel like they were properly tailored to become a cinematic experience, and when they've deviated places from the books just to make it more of a cinematic experience and make it work better as a film without actually kind of ruining the story. Whereas in Harry Potter, it just feels like they've crammed in as much as they can get away with, and it doesn't seem to have any love for film. It is just a telling of the books on a screen.
Yeah, and then too, Scott, going to your point about Lord of the Rings too, when they do deviate from the books, it seems mostly pointless. It's not because this will work better on film or it'll explain it better in a way that you have to do visually because you don't have like the internal monologues. It just seems willful and almost capricious. Like, we're going to do this a bit differently because it doesn't seem to achieve anything particular from it.
Here's my beef with the film, and if you listen to this podcast even vaguely regularly, you'll probably know that I haven't read any of the books. I've only seen the last three films, including this one, so I don't consider myself a Harry Potter fan. I kind of begrudgingly came in the final the final third of the films. Right, if you were to watch these films back to back, you're talking about eight films with let's say an average of 2 hours a film, so you've got 16 hours of cinema there over eight parts.
I think,
right?
You may want to increase that estimate considerably.
Yeah.
I think you're probably looking closer to 20 actually, but
right. So let's say, for argument's sake, 20 hours of film. If you were to watch even the theatrical cuts of The Lord of the Rings, put aside the extended trilogy, theatrical cut of Lord of the Rings comes in at like 9 to 10 hours or something like that.
It's around about that, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So half the length of time. It was a supremely crafted piece of filmmaking from start to finish. There's not a weak link in that chain. Three outstanding films, plot progression, character progression, fantastic conclusion, fantastic adaptations of the book. If you want to take a story arc and spread it over eight films, okay, and I've only seen the last three, so I'm not best placed to cast judgment on it, but you should still theoretically be able to walk into any of these films as a standalone entity and get some enjoyment out of it. If you want to tell a story over eight parts in 20 hours, the last part of that story better be mental. It better give me something I have never seen before in my life. It better blow me away. It better have some sort of fantastic emotional resonance, some sort of amazing spectacle. It better pull out every stop in the book and then a lot of stops that nobody even realised were there. It had better effectively push the boundaries of cinema.
It has to raise the bar so high, we don't even know there's a bar anymore.
Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2 does none of these things, and it does none of them in negative spades.
Is that a double negative?
At no point in this film, and it was a passable film in its own right, and to judge it as a standalone film, someone who's not a fan of series, if I walked into this, I'd think, yeah, that's an alright film. But if I've invested 10 years of my life in 20 hours of cinema, I'd better feel a hell of a lot more than that. If I were a Harry Potter fan, the more I think about it, I came out of the cinema thinking, yeah, it's alright, it's not bad, it's not the worst film I've ever seen. I preferred part, you know, Deathly Hallows Part 1. If I were a Harry Potter fan, the more I think about it now, I would be going absolutely scatty.
I think the problem is that it's competent, and that's essentially it. And most of the other films haven't been much more than competent. I think a lot of people will get more joy out of filling in the blanks with their memories of the books themselves rather than they will from the actual film itself. That's why I don't think this is going to have the same kind of legs as something like Star Wars, which is perhaps artificially been extended by Lucas, but
yeah.
It's not going to make the same impact. The books might, the films won't. They're an adjunct to the Potter universe. They're by no means
30 years from now, the children of our generation aren't going to be going back to these films to catch up, before they watch the new batch of Harry Potter films that have come out. There's going to be no interest in these whatsoever, surely.
No.
I don't know if it's the thing that annoyed me most about the whole thing as well, is I don't know if this crazy b-hatch, what's her name, J.K. Rowling, actually had this element in the book. You can't really give any spoilers for Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2, can you? Everybody knows what happens in it. What is with this crazy Deus Ex get out of Harry, we're going to build up some sort of emotional investment here in the fact that you're going to have to make this decision. You're going to have to, if you want to defeat Voldemort, you're going to have to sacrifice yourself. For him to, as you say, sort of mildly, begrudgingly go, oh, okay then, and traipse off into the woods, you know, in a bit of assault, kicking stones as he goes, sacrifice himself, stand there, get blasted by magic, just for him to die, and then have the fantastical get-out clause of, well, you can come back to life if you want. That's literally it. All right, wait a minute, I've just died for some reason, right, you've done that, now would you A, like to stay dead, or B, come back alive? Oh, dearie me, can I phone a friend? Can I ask the audience? I don't think there's any need. How, if after, I mean, seven books, is that the same in the book? Because after seven books, I would have liked to have thought she had it slightly better planned than that.
Effectively, yes, at least as far as I remember.
That's crazy, man. I would be so angry. I would have eaten that book. If I got to the end of that book and that's what, you know, that... what?
Yeah.
There are so many better ways of handling that situation, man. Does she pen that bit in a lunch break or something?
It seems odd, given that you've spent the whole, well, certainly all of this film talking about these Deathly Hallows, one being his invisibility cloak, which has been all the way throughout, one being that wand, which is the most powerful wand ever, and you've got one called the Resurrection Stone, which you think might have been more involved in this process, but it doesn't. It just lets him talk to some crap ghosts.
It's the Derek Akora brick, I think would be a better name for it. Oh, dear. Good God.
Yeah, I mean, I'm down on it just because, as you say, for this kind of conclusion to this amount of film, which is, you know, unprecedented, really. There's not too many series that I can think of that, you know, of a continuous storyline arc for this length of time. And it just sort of fizzles out and ends competently, which is fine. It's a competent film. It's not like if you've seen the first part of this, you shouldn't go and see the second part. That would be mental, but it's just okay, and I can't bring myself to be enthusiastic about it in the slightest.
The only popular film franchise to have like more installments than this, obviously, are the Bond films, and in no way, shape or form can you argue they've got a story arc, because they keep rebooting every 5 minutes or something. Yeah. And then after that, you have to go to schlocky horror franchises who have lived their last 10 installments on straight to DVD.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Mm. Halloween and Friday the 13th and stuff like that. What the hell, man? Come on, get your act together. I mean, J.K. Rowling doesn't care. She's richer than God. So after that, I don't think I can be bothered going back to the start and actually checking out the others now.
Well, you definitely don't want to do that, actually, because I had a notion which passed quite quickly to watch all of them again before watching the second part. I managed the first film, and that was an incredible struggle.
Really?
Quickly dispensed that with that as a terrible, terrible idea.
I was gonna suggest that the next time we all get the chance to get together in one location, we should just have like a Harry Potter marathon in one day.
Oh, Christ.
Like you and I did with the extended Lord of the Rings, Drew. But
yeah, but those were good films, Greg.
Yeah, we're going to say
people that can act in them.
Slightly more masochistic thing.
Alternatively, I'll give you a hammer and you can just hit me in the face with it. That's probably preferable.
They're more enjoyable than the first two films, but I unfortunately don't remember too much of the rest of them, but the first film was so terrible. And, as Scott mentioned about the actors having grown up with them and they've got so much better, it was almost painfully bad to begin with. So,
and now it's just bad.
Yeah, well, it's just,
they've come a long way.
There's been a massive transformation from what they were to begin with, but they were just so terrible to begin with, and I would think that most fans would just feel shortchanged by these films, most for the reasons that you said. They've invested a lot of the time and their youth in these books, they've read these, they know the stories really well, and it, as Scott said, it's nothing more than competent. There's no real satisfaction from them.
Yeah. I left the cinema sort of not really caring one way or another, thinking, well, that was 2 hours of my life. I suppose worse things could have happened to me in that 2 hours. Actually, the more I've thought about it after I've come away, just not feeling angry myself, because it's been no great blow to me. But I think, you know, I think if you were a Harry Potter fan and you were expected to be satisfied with that, I think you'd be kidding yourself if you tried to claim that it was a great conclusion and that it was worth you having invested all that time. I think you'd be in denial, frankly. But there you go. That's just me. What do I know? Larry Crown, then. Tom Hanks and She Who Shall Not Be Named. Therefore, I was never down on the list to go and see this one. Drew, can you give some sort of plot recap on Larry Crown?
No.
Scott, can you give some sort of plot recap on Larry Crown?
So as the person who's seen it, yeah, I suppose I can. I'm better placed for this.
You getting them reviews out, Batley.
Right, so Tom Hanks steps back behind the camera for his second directorial effort in 15 years, feature film anyway, and also steps back out in front of it again, taking the lead role of Larry Crown. Larry's a middle-aged shop worker who's passed over for promotion several times in favour of some oafish co-workers, finally told to part company with a job that he quite bafflingly loves so much. He went straight from the Navy to this job in a Walmart-like place. So he doesn't have any kind of college education, which in this company at least is mandatory for kind of working in a suit and tie as a sort of middle management role. In the wintry economic climate, there's no alternative jobs for Larry, so he and his mortgage payments on a house become increasingly tough to meet, so on and so forth. He decides to take some action on this by enrolling at a local college. He takes a business course with a module in interpersonal communications, hoping to become a more attractive prospective hire. But seeing as this is a romantic comedy, you can of course be sure that he will find a whole lot more in ways as laden with barely believable cliches as you would expect in a romantic comedy. He's sold off his gas-guzzling truck in favour of a more economical scooter to get about in, and because of this he falls in with a group of fellow scooter enthusiasts at the local college, all mostly half his age and coming across rather like a Hell's Angels chapter chaired by Mary Poppins. Amongst this motley assortment of misfits and hipsters is Crown's classmate Talia, played by Gugu Mbatha Rao, or something like that. One of the more free-spirited / outgoing / friendly / ditzy of the bunch, who takes Crown under her wing to renovate his dress sense and general outlook on life. Meanwhile, Crown's communications teacher, the improbably named Mercedes Tynot, played by Julia Roberts, who is the must-not-be-named of Craig's introduction, she's having relationship problems of her own and takes out somewhat in her class. Grumpy and direct, she seems to be the exact opposite of Larry, and I'm sure you can guess what happens from therein, including some predictable misunderstandings regarding Crown's relationship with Talia. Now, Larry Crown does not break any new ground in the slightest, and even by the standards of a romantic comedy, this stretches believability well past breaking point. Arguably, if you're going to bring up the very real and miserable consequences of the global financial collapse, then an upbeat, somewhat schmaltzy comedy isn't exactly the forum for it, and I can see why this would put a lot of people off. I can also see why casting Julia Roberts might put a lot of people off, but seeing as for once she's actually scripted as an unlikable character for the vast bulk of the film, this actually kind of works for me, harnessing as it does her innate unlikability. Alright. Everyone involved is fine. The characters aren't particularly believable, but their performances, in particular from Hanks and Gugu Mbatha Rao, are exuberant and likeable, which allows the film some leeway and kind of carries it through some of its flakier moments. There's a decent level of chemistry between the cast members, and while the dialogue doesn't sparkle, it at the very least is occasionally quite shiny. It's aimed more at a breezy, bright, feel-good sector of the market, and in this climate, it just never had a chance of meeting the withering cynicism that austerity measures and endemic media, police and political corruption have brought us in recent months. However, if you can find any room in your heart that's not been blackened by modern life yet, or you just want a few hours of escapism, Larry Crown does actually achieve what it wants to do quite well. It just doesn't seem that what it's doing is in demand at the minute, and it's not good enough to warrant any kind of renaissance further down the line. I'm sure this will just become an unremarkable footnote to the careers of all involved, and it deserves better, but the timing is against it. It's just not a product anyone particularly cares for in this market, as far as I can gather. It's had some atrocious reviews from almost everyone. I think they're being unfair. It's, as romantic comedies go, it's not breaking any more grounds. It's middle of the road, but it's certainly not bad. It is not the most dreadful thing you'll ever see. It's just out of time at the minute. It is just not what people want to see at the minute. If this film had come out in, I don't know, 95 or something like that, it would have been, you know, met with reasonably opened arms and people would go, oh yeah, that's fine, you know, whatever. And I think everyone's a bit more miserable at the minute and just isn't prepared to put up with anything that's kind of sugary coated, and that's perhaps a little sad for all involved. I think it deserves better than it's getting, but at the same time, I can't actually recommend people go and see it, because there are better examples out there if you need to go and see it, something that's more light-hearted and romantic. But if you do wind up watching it, I really don't think it's so bad. That is faint praise at best. It's enjoyable enough for what it needs to do. It's kind of unambitious, is probably the only real criticism I've got of it. But for the most part, it's amusing. And for 2 hours, it's a perfectly fine way to spend an evening. But I wouldn't have anyone rush out and break down the doors to go and see it.
Isn't Tom Hanks just getting a bit too old for this shit?
Yes, but that is kind of half the point of the film. It's because he's an adult going back and having his ideas challenged of the youth of today and yada yada yada. So it does kind of take care of that in the plotting.
I noticed in the cast list Cedric the Entertainer, isn't he dead?
Well, he wasn't in this film.
Is that someone else I'm thinking
You're
of?
Thinking of the guy from Ocean's 11, I think, Bernie Mac.
Bernie Mac, that's who I was thinking of. Sorry, Bernie, I didn't, I know I haven't offended you, mate, but, yeah. Right then. You all know what my favourite film franchise of the last 10 years has been. Transformers. Oh no, wait! It's my least favourite. Bereft of any redeeming features whatsoever. In its first instalment, I didn't bother with the second, and therefore I feel completely comfortable berating the third without having had, or indeed indulged, any desire to see it either. Third instalment of CG robots beating 7 bells out of each other, Drew, how exciting is it?
About as exciting as being told you've got the clap.
Hey!
Transformers.
If I were offered those two options, I'd have to think long and hard.
So would I, actually. This is... The clap might make me sad, but not necessarily angry, and I could do without being angry. Transformers: The Dark of the Moon. Some Autobot spaceship has crash-landed on the moon in the 1950s. That's what the space race was all about, to try and get whatever was there. Yada yada, retcon shite. Human hero of the previous films, Sam Witless Witwicky, is unemployed, something he considers rather unfair since he has now saved the world twice, and he never hears from his Autobot friends. He's finally offered a job by a gurning out-of-place John Malkovich, and he's offered this job just in time to find that someone at his new company knows secrets about the plans of the evil Decepticon, plans that will destroy the Earth! Plans far too stupid for me to bother repeating. Suffice to say that the Decepticons are bad. Naughty robots. But no one will believe Sam. Hardly surprising, since Shia LaBeouf's performance as Sam in his third installment of the franchise is unconvincing, annoying and weak. Not that he's alone. There are no good performances in this film, even from established thespians like Frances McDormand. Though, given the drivel they've been given to work with, it's not in any way surprising, and I'm quite sure many of them just had bills to pay. Newcomer Rosie Huntington-Whiteley, who got some of the biggest press coverage in the run-up to Transformers because she replaced Megan Fox as Sam Witwicky's love interest after Megan Fox was sacked for comparing Michael Bay to Hitler, is adequate. That's all you can really say about Rosie Huntington-Whiteley. She's not unlikable, and what lines she is given are delivered in a non-awful way. But no true judgment of her acting prowess can be gleaned from this steaming turd of a film, because she's not there to act. She's there to be leered at and perved over, her preference from a paparazzi-like position in the gutter as she exits various cars in short, tight dresses. And that's symptomatic of what's wrong with this film. It's a film for 12-year-old boys, unfortunately directed by a lecherous middle-aged man with the mind and movie-making ability of a 12-year-old boy. And any 12-year-old boys wishing to look at Ms. Huntington-Whiteley would surely be better served by the products of her jade job, that of a Victoria's Secret model. This is supposed to be a movie, with a story. Now, I was willing to give Transformers 3 a pass for the first 30 minutes, in which nothing much happens. Now, while the dialogue is clunky and the story is weak, it's an action film, and a good number of well-crafted action sequences would make it a worthwhile watch for many people, so I patiently awaited them. Unfortunately, the story becomes overwhelmingly stupid and that the scriptwriter willfully and with gay abandon undermines or entirely disregards the story of the alien robots and their relationship with Earth as established in the first Transformers film. Everything is seemingly made of C4, and enough stuff blowing up is something of a trademark of Michael Bay's, but he's taken it too far when even glass starts exploding in flames, and the supposed comic relief from the miniature Autobots and Sam's witless parents isn't funny. It's sad, desperate and crass. Even the film's climax is a letdown. Now, while the CGI, as it has been in these films throughout, is of a very high quality, the scene is very nearly a carbon copy of the end of the first film, with the Autobots and a small group of human soldiers trading blows with a superior Decepticon force in the middle of a city, while Shia LaBeouf runs between them to do something. Capture the enemy's flag, I think. And this goes on for many, many hours.
Oh, sorry. I can't help it. So, just to recap so far, Shia LaBeouf is a charisma-free sad sack. We have some female love interest who is there basically to bare her arse cheeks at every given opportunity, usually while bending over something. Big CG robots smacking each other about, but with huge expanses of nothing happening in between. Why is it you like the first one then?
That's a good question. I don't know. The first one just seemed kind of fun.
I don't mean that in a harsh way. That sounded quite harsh. It's one of the few things I've never managed to reconcile with anybody, let alone my two best mates, is how the hell you guys enjoyed the first one.
I don't know. I haven't given enough thought to be able to give you a good answer on that just now.
Just something you can't quite qualify.
I was just finding the first one kind of fun. There was a bit of humour in it. The CGI was impressive. There were some decent action sequences. And it didn't seem quite so stupid as this. Whether I would feel quite the same going back now, I simply don't know. But there's too much copying in this, apart from all the other problems. I mean, when I say the final sequence is nearly a carbon copy, I mean, it's really not any exaggeration at all. It's so incredibly similar. To the point that you could just have edited in the last sequence and people may not have noticed. And though it did praise the quality of the effects, well, they are very good, as they were in the first film too.
You can't fault the effects work.
No, you can fault the direction though, and the choice of effects, because it's really rather pointless at the end, since it's almost impossible to follow what's happening, and especially to know which silvery robot thing is which. The other problems with the film are less obvious, perhaps. Well, actually, maybe they're not. Because in its defence, it's a very inclusive film. Because it set us out to insult everybody. Black people, Ukrainian people, Arabic people, women people, awake and breathing people. You know, nobody's missed out. I mean, there are so many flaws and so much inappropriate content for its rating. And so many worrying attitudes to, amongst others, women and, well, pretty much any non-Americans, that I could go on talking about them for at least the running length of the film, which is considerable. But I won't. I'll just finish up here. I'll just say, do yourself a favour. Watch something. Anything else.
Damn. Scott, anything you want to add to that? Or does that sum it up pretty neatly?
Well, I'm trying to be a more upbeat and positive and optimistic person. So, in my role as devil's advocate, I'll say this. It's designed as a massive budget CG spectacle, and it is. It's not designed in any way to have any sort of narrative, and it doesn't fail to disappoint on that score. The effects work, at least it does look expensive. You can tell where all the money's gone. It's not like some of these films where you hear that it's got a massive budget and it ends up looking dreadful. I mean, this, every dollar is on the screen. It kind of justifies that budget. It's very well done. It's not to my taste at all, for the same reason Drew had. I can't tell which robot's which. There's the occasional flash of colour to tell me that the bad guys are typically silver and there's normally a little bit of colour in the Autobots. But it's vastly confusing about what was going on and what's supposed to be happening with any of them. Plus the fact that it seems to be taking great delight in showing you robots getting ripped apart, but you can't really tell what's damaging, what isn't, because they're robots, you know?
I was just going to say, presumably it's all rendered slightly more difficult if you're watching the 3D version through your special darkening glasses.
No doubt.
Maybe the one thing it does have in its favour, just because of not wanting to wait 3 hours, I did end up watching the 3D version of this. The 3D, as much as this goes, is very good because it's 70% genuinely shot in 3D. And it's some of the best 3D I've seen. But it's still utterly pointless, and it doesn't make... You can't polish a turd with good 3D. No. But
I'll also say, right, the effects work and the stunt work, when it's talking about humans as well, is pretty good, I thought. Now, it's not perfect, but you do get flashes of the sort of work that brought Michael Bay to the stands in the first place, things like The Rock and Armageddon. It does have some kind of character to it. The whole bit towards the end of that kind of building falling over. It's a good cut. It's a good little scene. You know, the action scenes have kind of been well thought out for the most part. But your problem is when a lot of the film is trying to bring characterization to big chunks of CG metal, and that's a complete waste of time. It's just not going to work. I mean, the bulk of the plot is, and I use the term loosely, is revolving around disappointment and betrayal amongst big CG robots and the Autobots, and that's just never going to work. There's the odd decent line from the supporting cast, but it's not enough to really save anything. But that's really about as positive as I can be. Like I said, I just don't buy Shia LaBeouf as an action hero. I like him in all straight dramas, but he's just not convincing at all in this. The effects work's messy. And I think most galling for me as someone who played with the toys as a kid is I have no idea who any of these Autobots are. You know, outside of Optimus and Bumblebee. It's like, who is this French one? Why is there a couple of fat Scottish ones? I mean, as someone who's like brought up on the cartoons and the toys, which all had like pretty strong, distinct identities, I just don't know who any of these clowns are.
Yeah, and why doesn't Megatron apparently transform into anything ever?
That's
kind of the point of it. Also, I don't remember. I know it wasn't in the first. I'm quite certain it wasn't the first one. I don't remember much of the second one at all. But I think it's new for this one. They've decided to make the robots bleed.
Excellent.
Quite a lot of the time, you'll just see loads of red liquid pouring out of robots.
I think I don't think Michael Bay's, and this is controversial, I don't think Michael Bay is a director without his merits, because you mentioned his two really good, really enjoyable, really fun films, Scott, which were Armageddon and The Rock, both of which were completely overbaked, at that point he didn't have his head completely up his arse. He still enjoyed quite a long runtime, but I think the key is in those films he surrounded himself with casts who were quite aware of how ridiculous it was, and who sort of who played up in their acting chops
in pretty much
the same sense that Michael Bay does in an over-the-top directing way. And all the other films of his I've seen, he's working with a cast who are clearly there to pick up a paycheck and who can't actually be bothered with it, and who perhaps take it too seriously. And maybe that's key. I recently discovered that Michael Bay is not without a sense of humour, and he's very aware of the reputation he has. Have you seen the commercial he did for Verizon?
No.
Get your ass on YouTube and search for Michael Bay Verizon commercial, and you'll have a good laugh. The man's not averse to having a laugh at himself. He actually seems like quite a decent guy. How much you can judge that on the length of a 45-second commercial, I don't know. But oh my God, he needs someone in the editing room to tell him when to stop, surely.
Well, I suppose is...
You've got a problem when someone could turn around and tell you, Michael, chop an hour out of that. You're not making Private Ryan, Michael.
You stand to lose an hour. But on the other hand, it's made $1 billion.
So somebody in the editing room may be saying stop, but... Someday in the market or the economics department, maybe I'll be saying, no, carry on.
Until he suffers one catastrophic failure, he's going to keep on doing this. And the audience isn't going to be any happier for it, but they're still going to go and see them. So
The problem is, right, that we went through a period there for a long time, for like 15, 20 years, where like no film with any sort of ambition for commercial success could be more than 90 minutes long, because the studios were adamant, keep it short, it's all about turnover in the cinema, it's all about how many shows we can do per day. Lord of the Rings stuck its foot completely up that ass, and there was a glimmer of hope there, but it's like, oh right, okay, now we're going to get some intelligent big budget summer films where the studios are like, do you know what, all right, okay, have 2.5 hours at a push kind of thing, that's not, okay, that's brilliant, because Lord of the Rings proved that you can still pack out cinemas with a film that runs to 3 hours and make a metric shit ton of money. Well, hasn't it all gone wrong now? Why is a film like this running to 2.75 hours? Surely the studio should be stepping in there going, all very well, Michael, but chop an hour off it, it will still be just as good a film, you know, for any given value of good, and we'll be able to show it more times. Why is this man being let away with it? Someone needs to rein him in a bit, man. He's gone mental.
We'll write a stiffly worded email to the editor of the Times.
Whatever, Michael Bay, you know what you're going to get. It's just a shame.
But it's not better.
Bridesmaids, then. It's one of those films that seems to have come along from out of nowhere and has proven quite a hit with audiences, garnering strong word of mouth. Drew, what is the deal with Bridesmaids?
Yes, Bridesmaids. It's a film. Bridesmaids is the latest film from the Judd Apatow production train. Somebody who perhaps not necessarily can do no wrong, but does pretty right most of the time. It stars Kristen Wiig as Annie, whose best friend is getting married and wants her to be a maid of honour. Annie's having a pretty crappy time in life. She's got very little money, her bakery business went bust, she's making bad choices about people to have relationships with. Then she starts fighting with her best friend's new friend, who wants to take over the planning of the wedding. And it all sounds very meh so far. It sounds quite predictable. Sounds like about 1,000 chick flicks about weddings, 27 dresses, which is awful, Maid of Honour, which I've not ever heard good things about, anything with Katie Hudson, which will be awful. Fortunately, though, this is actually very funny. The characters are considerably more likeable and believable than they typically are in this sort of film. It's funny to both sexes. There's not too much more to say about the plot. I mean, a lot of it pans out exactly as you would expect, but the difference is that, I don't know, unlike pretty much every other romantic comedy, really, or maybe 1 in 20 that aren't awful or mediocre at best. Yeah, I don't know what I want to say. It's funny. Fuck yeah. No, so I don't...
It's funny. Fuck yeah. Scott, it's been described as... Scott, it's been described as a female Hangover. A fair comparison?
Well, it's very much the elevator pitch for it, isn't it? It's the Hangover, but with girls! Who can fail? It's understandable. I can see why you go with that. The trailer didn't help in the slightest. The trailer I found repulsive, but it completely, well, it doesn't really miss-sell or represent the film. It just shows you bits of the film that are, in the context of the film, very funny, but when taken out, just dreadful. But regardless of that, if memory serves, this is the best comedy I've seen this year. I can't think of anything much funnier. In terms of the sort of Todd Phillips / Judd Apatow kind of R-rated comedy films, it's probably got a more compelling narrative than all the rest of them, which is not really the primary reason you would go and watch any of it, but it is stronger and more sensible than, well, certainly any of the Todd Phillips ones, like The Hangover. The characters are, well, massively exaggerated, as befits the genre. They're still... have a kernel of believability, and they're all, well, the ones that are supposed to be sympathetic are, the ones that aren't. The rivalries and friendships show a great chemistry, the performances are perfectly pitched, and the comedy writing's as good as anything that either the Phillips or Apatow stables have put out. As with most comedies, there's not an awful lot to say about them other than whether I found them funny or not, and I most certainly did. And if you've ever shown any inclination at all for the sort of films that fall under whatever umbrella term we're using these days for Hangover-like R-rated comedies, thankfully they've stopped using Gross Out, and that term's faded, but I can't think of the other collective noun for these kind of films. But if this is the sort of thing that you like, then you'll love Bridesmaids. It's a must-see film. One of the best comedies I've seen in recent years. Best I've seen this year. So, yeah, highly recommended.
Boom! Recommended! Sorry, Drew, you were going to say something there.
I've nothing really to add to what Scott says. It's just...
Boom! Nothing to add!
It's kind of unusual for a comedy to be just over the two-hour mark, but while there's a subplot with Annie and Chris O'Dowd's character, Officer Rhodes, that provides some laughs. It's ultimately unnecessary. It could easily have been excised in order to speed things up a little, but even with that in it, just over 2 hours, it doesn't ever feel like that at all. It passes really quite swiftly, and the level of funny never really dips much, which is kind of unusual. Modern comedy, particularly, anything to do with weddings, certainly.
No funny dips.
Yes. I see my plan to not prepare for this particular film worked out spiffingly well again. as it so often
Boom,
does.
Boom! Spiffing non-plan! Let's just draw a line under it there. It's really good! Cell 211, 211, 211, 21 plus... Well, not plus one, 21 with the one stuck on the end and the other shifted over one column to the left. Or... alternatively,
were you prepared much for this introduction, Craig?
Two shifted one column to the left and the other one inserted in the tens column between the two, which is now in the hundreds column, and the one in the units column, which hasn't moved. It's a Spanish film, is it, Scott?
Why, yes, it is.
Or was it originally a French film, but it got shifted one country to the left?
That's probably what happened.
Became Spanish.
Oh. How's about this for a shitty day at work? You're knocked out by a piece of falling masonry, and while you're out, the prison you're touring with as an orientation to starting work as a guard the next day undergoes a riot and is taken over by the prisoners, and you're left in there. Your only option for survival, it seems, is to pretend to be a newly transferred prisoner and hope that your bluffing skills are enough to get you through. This is just the fate that befalls Alberto Arman, Juan Oliver, as things don't get much better for him over the coming days. He wins over the local strongman and leader of the riot, Malmadri, played by Luis Tosar, by some inventive ideas that seem to help the rioters in their position over the guards, and he soon becomes one of the Malmadri's most trusted allies. Getting closer to the guy leading the riot might seem like a way to save your skin, but it's not helping him get out and reunite with his pregnant wife Elena. And the longer he stays on the wrong side of the bars, the greater the risk of someone finding out his secret, which is unlikely to work out well for him. The situation outside isn't helping. Some political complications regarding the members of ETA in the prison, and some spectacularly ropey decisions by the guards, which have the whiff of dramatic narrative convenience rather than any believable planning, leads to escalations in the situation that bring the film to a surprising ending, with characters developing in pleasingly surprising ways, and giving a more poignant ending than I'd certainly have expected going in. While I'll be damned if I can actually place where I've seen something like this before, it does feel at least conceptually similar, although I'll happily accept corrections on that. But familiar or not, it's a very, very enjoyable drama. The lead performances are terrifically strong, and the characters don't seem all that far-fetched, certainly within the context of the film. There's a small amount of pantomime villainy on occasion, and it's often more in service of driving a narrative than explainable by any character motivation, but I don't think that detracts at all from the film. It almost barely impinged on my enjoyment of it. It is, I guess, relatively violent, although never gratuitously, but it's certainly not a film for the faint of heart. Quite why a film from, I believe, 2009 was briefly released into UK cinemas a couple of weeks back is beyond me, but I'm very glad that it was, and it is certainly worth tracking down, and it's one of the better dramas I've seen all this year. Another highly recommended one.
Boom! Worth tracking down!
Yes, indeed.
Drew, did you see Cell Digits?
I did, yes.
And what did you think of it?
It's good.
Is it good and that?
It's good and that, yeah. It's really a very enjoyable drama indeed. The fact that it was awarded 8 Goya Awards, that's, for those people not familiar with it, is the Spanish equivalent of the BAFTAs and the Oscars, they're deserved, but you think that such a highly regarded film might have come out in a time frame lesser than 2 years. But as Scott said, it's good that it has. It had me slightly concerned when I started watching it that it was going to be perhaps a bit like Edward Bunker's Animal Factory, which was going to be sort of exposé of prison, but might leave you with feeling that, yeah, I get it, prison's shit, but you're telling me nothing. I expected prison to be a horrible place. But it's much more than that. It's got a lot more complexities in it. Excellent performances, some surprising character development. I really don't want to waste anybody's time. I agree with most of what Scott said, it's very good.
Yeah, so we'll catch you again soon, guys. Remember, if you want to email us, it's podcast@theoneliner.com. Other than that, I will bid you adieu. I, as always, was Craig. Drew was Drew.
I was.
And Scott was Scott.
Bye.
Yeah. Bye. Boom. Bye.